Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Tallahassee Regional Airport, offering service through U.S. Airways with direct flights from Tallahassee to Charlotte and Washington, D.C., and over 200 connections to destinations around the globe. Fares and information available online at usairways.com. Lisa Miller and Associates, offering strategies to solve legislative, regulatory, and business development challenges. Every challenge offers new opportunities for individually tailored client solutions. Online at lisamillerassociates.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 500,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace, online at flaflcio.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Despite Governor Rick Scott's push to grow jobs in Florida, some say the state's business climate needs more deregulation.
Overall, you're seeing a system of government-granted privilege with some exceptions here and there that are creating privilege for specific groups and specific industries.
Also tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, the bill will be left pending, and we will have another committee meeting next week.
Sometimes lawmakers run out of time to vote on bills, and a former state senator thinks he knows what's behind the timing issues. We'll also talk about kids who are Baker-acted by their schools and visit some retired racing greyhounds. It's week number 7 of the Florida Legislature's 2014 lawmaking session. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. During the past several years, Governor Rick Scott has touted Florida as a refuge from burdensome regulations and has made it a goal to get more business into the state. Florida's unemployment rate has fallen below the national average during that time, but as Lynn Hatter reports, some groups argue the state continues to over-regulate businesses, and at least one group is targeting several industries they say are primed for deregulation.
Many of you are also members of the Institute. For that, I thank you. If you're not, please consider joining JMI. There's a whole bunch of materials as you walk out this back door. And once again, thank you all for being here.
It's a room full of round tables and men and women in dark suits. The James Madison Institute, a free market think tank, is putting on a luncheon to talk about one of its top issues, business regulation.
You see elected officials come into office and trying to dereg, which by and large we at the James Madison Institute would agree with.
JMI President Bob McClure likens state business regulation to a pendulum. Take when Governor Rick Scott first took office. He abolished the state's growth management agency and, in doing so, managed to scale back numerous regulations placed on local governments in areas like zoning. But on the other side of the pendulum are industries that fight deregulation. Claudia Edenfield is an attorney with the Institute for Justice. It's a libertarian-leaning nonprofit law firm specializing in economics and private property.
And it is important not to deregulate whole cloth, but to really enact health and safety regulations that will benefit the public instead of regulations that are simply designed to and simply have the effect of shutting people out and preventing competition for the people who are already in business.
Edenfield, along with the James Madison Institute, have released a study they call the Dirty Dozen, a list of 12 professions they say could use a regulation trim. That list includes auctioneers, travel agents, funeral directors, household movers, and interior designers, cosmetologists, and barbers.
What the government should be trying to do is legislating for health and safety reasons and not for protecting people from things they don't need protecting from, like bad haircuts.
Edenfield argues industries should self-regulate, but some industries don't want to be deregulated, and not everyone believes it's in the state nor the consumer's best interest to roll back training requirements.
What we study in cosmetology, we study from bacteriology, not teaching students how not to transfer certain diseases, how to keep bacteria down in their salons, because we all know that germs reside in wet places. They also
Renee Rollins runs World Class Academy Beauty School and Salon on the south side of Tallahassee. She's a member of the Florida Association of Post-Secondary Schools, licensed to do business in the state, and has been a cosmetologist for more than 30 years. She takes her job seriously and says getting licensed in Florida is more than just being able to do hair. It's knowing what's going on with a client.
So you have to be familiar with how that disease looks. You know, if a person had piteous psoriasis of the scalp, you know, that's a bad, dandruff problem. You can't just go into a person's head with no knowledge of that, because you can pass that on to yourself as well as someone else.
You know, even me, it's the first time ever I'm doing my hair in Tallahassee.
Miami Democratic Representative Daphne Campbell is sitting under a hairdryer. It's Campbell's first time visiting Rollins' shop. She's in Tallahassee for the legislative session. Rollins says she doesn't want cosmetology students to lose training in professionalism and shop management, business basics that are taught in school. In 2011, the legislature tried and failed to deregulate several industries, including cosmetology and interior design. Campbell was among the lawmakers who voted against deregulation.
You know, to me, that bill was unnecessary because it's no way you think I'm going to go to all cosmetologies and then I don't even know you have license.
This year, Florida lawmakers are faced with several industry regulation decisions. The state is looking to regulate the practice of telemedicine, for example, outlining rules for which doctors should be able to see patients remotely. It's considering removing a ban on 64-ounce bottles of beer, called growlers, something that would benefit small breweries and is opposed by large companies. To regulate or deregulate? That is the question only the legislature can answer in the final weeks of session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Although Florida lawmakers filed more than 1,800 bills this year, most measures were not destined to become laws. Some were too controversial in an election year. Some died alone with no companion measure in the other chamber. And as Jessica Palumbo reports, some bill sponsors simply lost the race against time.
When lawmakers return from the Passover Easter break next week, they'll jump into a fast-paced final 2 weeks of floor action. But the majority of legislative movement has already happened in committee meetings. Meetings that are scheduled to last for an exact period of time and not a minute longer.
And I appreciate the opportunity to raise some concerns about the bill as it's been amended.
If you could do that in about 2 minutes, I would appreciate it.
I promise you, my comments are short.
That exchange between public commenter Brenda Olson and House Regulatory Affairs Committee Chair Doug Holder is not uncommon, especially in a room full of public speakers who are passionate about controversial legislation. When the Senate Transportation Committee took up a bill preempting local limousine service restrictions, they did so with 10 minutes left on the committee's 90-minute clock.
I know there's going to be a lot of discussion. There has been a lot of discussion on this. I would move for a time-certain vote at 10:29.
A time-certain vote means discussion will be cut off and a vote taken. Or as former longtime State Senator Bob McKnight puts it,
this simply says, even if there's a fire in the building, we're still going to have this vote at XYZ time.
The bill up for discussion had taxi cab companies up in arms. Several of their operators had driven or flown in from across the state. Then there was Christina Bicciacci. She co-owns a Miami limo service and came to support the bill, which was aimed at making it easier for smartphone app Uber to enter Florida's cities.
Out of six people that had presented a card to be able to be speakers on behalf of this new proposal, I was the only one that was allowed to speak, and halfway through my speech, I was cut off by Senator Margolis.
Here's Bicciacci testifying.
In addition to helping my husband run his business, I am a nurse. When patients come to my hospital, they have the choice of two other hospitals within 6 miles.
Not talking about hospitals.
So why can't visitors and residents in Florida have a choice to their transportation needs? Thank you.
In the same committee room, transportation company manager Roger Chapin was also waiting to speak after traveling from Orlando. But before he could approach the lectern, the clock reached the meeting's end time of 10:30. The time certain motion had been withdrawn in the frantic final seconds to allow for a quick vote on an amendment, but time ran out on the bill itself. Chapin says one hopeful speaker had paid more than $900 to make the trip.
It's just sad that they don't have the time necessary to at least feel, make people feel like they're part of the process.
McKnight, who served in both Florida chambers during the 1970s and 80s, agrees. He's an outspoken critic of term limits, which he says have led to an inexperienced legislature less equipped to budget its time.
There's some that came before you that worked pretty hard to establish precedents, to try to contemplate some of the unforeseen circumstances governed properly. It probably could be ruled out of order. It could possibly even be ruled illegal.
McKnight says the Constitution guarantees the public a right to speak up on proposed laws.
And it doesn't limit. It doesn't say, well, you get 3 minutes in a subcommittee, you get five. It doesn't say that. It says you have access to your government.
In the limousine bills case, a hearing was scheduled for the following week. Bichacci said she hoped to return from Miami to try and testify again, but it would be difficult with two jobs and three children at home. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Still to come on Capitol Report, we'll hear what's working and what's not working regarding a law aimed at helping Florida's foster youth.
We need additional foster homes and housing options for the young adults. So because of the increased population, the increased need, we need more recruitment, and we need that to be met.
A Florida school sends a troubled student off for involuntary psychiatric evaluation. Should there be a law requiring the parents to be called right away?
The safety and the security of our students is our highest priority. So once we call the police, then we make every effort to reach out to the parents.
Advocates are pushing for more from a bill that would track greyhound injuries on racetracks. They say their concern is less about the dogs and more about the conditions they're kept in off the track. After all, owners say their dogs do like to run.
It's hard to take a statement like that and say, no, they don't like to run, because I don't believe that that's true. My dogs love to play. But I could pick any dog on the street and say the same thing about that.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too, on the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment.
Thanks to a law passed last year, Florida's foster kids can now remain in the foster care system until they reach the age of 21. Although that law overall seems to be doing what supporters said it should, Sasha Cordner reports both the state's child welfare agency as well as some foster kids themselves say a few changes may still be needed.
It's been barely a year since the Nancy C. Dietert Common Sense and Compassion Independent Living Act got signed into law, and it's only been a few months since the law authored by Dietert took effect. By extending the time children can remain in foster care, Dietert says the idea is to make sure older foster kids have the tools needed before they go out on their own.
That age from 18 to 21 is to be able to produce citizens that can then leave the system, be out of care, and be independent, and be good workers and good little taxpayers instead of, you know, homeless, unemployed, or in jail.
The Florida Department of Children and Families works with the community-based care organizations known as CBCs to provide services for foster care youth and parents. Normally, included in those services are periodic classes foster youth attend, which teach so-called life skills in a classroom setting.
Well, when we talk about life skills, we're talking about financial management. Can they balance a checkbook? You know, can they cook for themselves, or if they would rather go shop and purchase, you know, do they have an idea of nutrition and health management and those sorts of things?
That's Christy Gilmore, the Chief of Policy and Practice for DCF's Office of Child Welfare. She's speaking during one of several videos tailored toward foster parents and foster youth to help them understand the new law. Now the responsibility of teaching those life skills to foster youth are transferred to foster parents and group home primary caregivers, who also receive an increase in pay. Also under the new statute, foster youth aging out of the system get to choose from several options. Among them is what's called extended foster care for those who must be in high school or have a GED or be working for 80 hours a month. Christian Aguilar from Miami is currently enrolled in that program.
There's The reason I enrolled in Texas under foster care was because I knew I was going to age out of the foster care system, and I was scared because I didn't know what was going to happen to me.
He says while he wishes there were more avenues to provide legal representation for those in the program, he sees the benefits.
What I like about being in extended foster care is definitely the fact that I know that I have a type of support system behind me to guide me. It helps a lot when you need help from like a parent figure to make the right decisions in life, school, and like on an everyday life basis.
The new law also creates what's called post-secondary education services and support, or PESS, which Georgina Rodriguez is enrolled.
A young adult is allowed to take 9 credits in college eligible for post-secondary funding. And that really allows young adults to go and get full-time employment and be able to become self-sufficient prior to turning age 23.
Under that program, foster youth are also eligible for a monthly stipend. That money is not taken away even if they qualify for financial aid or a scholarship, which Rodriguez says she likes. But she says the implementation of the actual program needs a bit more work.
Implement some kind of state guideline for coordinators to follow so that everyone across the state are on the same page and follows one rule. So an example of this would be different areas throughout the state interpret how whether or not a young adult must enroll and attend college over the summer to receive post-secondary education support services.
And speaking before a recent Senate Children, Families, and Elder Affairs Committee hearing, Stephen Pennypacker praised the new law, but the DCS Assistant Program Secretary says he too believes there are some areas that need improvement, starting with their recruitment efforts.
We need additional foster homes and housing options for the young adults. So because of the increased population, the increased need for them to have a place to stay and for foster parents to be able to house the young adults, we need more recruitment and we need that to be met.
The new law took effect January 1st. According to DCF, over a two-month period, January to February, 164 foster youth elected to go into the extended foster care program until the age of 21, and 602 are enrolled in the post-secondary education services and support program until the age of 23. Also within that same time frame, close to 60% elected to stay in the foster care system. Those who opted not to still get the chance to enter back into the foster care system under the new law. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Corker.
Let's say a child has been going through some tough times. One day the child acts up in school. It's so serious that school officials have the child taken into custody and sent off for psychiatric evaluation. Under those circumstances, you'd assume a phone call to the parents would be made almost instantly. But as Jill Roberts with member station WQCS reports, at least one member of the Florida legislature thinks a new law is needed to make sure those calls are made.
A piece of legislation introduced this session by Stewart Republican Gail Harrell deals with parental notification when a minor child has been involuntarily remanded for psychological evaluation through the Baker Act. She says the legislation was inspired by an incident in her district.
I had a constituent come and with what I thought was just an incredible situation. His daughter was Baker Acted in school and was taken to a receiving facility, and he was never notified.
Harrell's legislation, House Bill 497, has been through two subcommittees and the House Education Committee so far. It seeks to remedy that situation.
And we're going to require all schools and charter schools that we have purview over to make sure that a parent is notified as soon as possible within a very reasonable amount of time that their child has been removed from campus.
In this particular case, it was the Renaissance Charter School in Port St. Lucie where the incident occurred. The child's father, whom we will identify only by his first name, Eric, in order to protect his daughter's identity, admits that his daughter was depressed and stressed over school testing. But he says he would have liked to have been called in before police were notified.
One phone call, basically, from the teacher, whoever was seeing the problem, would resolve this whole thing by one phone call to us, because we could come and just resolve this peacefully instead to go through to very painful the action which was taken.
In this case, according to the father, the child was released to her parents when those who evaluated her found no need to keep her under Baker Act provisions, and she remains enrolled in the school. Her father, however, is unhappy to be financially responsible for that examination.
Of course, because I don't think that if we didn't prompt the whole action, then we should pay for the cost.
Colleen Reynolds is spokeswoman for the Renaissance School. She can't speak to the particular situation because of privacy issues, but did talk with us about the school's policy for dealing with situations which may involve a student who is a danger to themselves or others.
The safety and the security of our students is our highest priority. So once we call the police, then we make every effort to reach out to the parents. If we are unable to reach the parents for whatever reason, if they don't answer their phone or if their number's disconnected, then in that case, we certainly will not impede any police action that needs to be taken at that point. We would cooperate with authorities.
Parental involvement is a key part of the process when considering the Baker Act of a minor, according to Sergeant Frank Sable of the Port St. Lucie Police Department.
We try to exhaust all means necessary to get the parents involved so we can get a little background and some history, because sometimes, you know, the parents will say, yes, I've noticed a behavior change, or I've noticed that, you know, my child has done this and that. I am kind of worried about, you know, what they may or may not do.
The increase in cases of teenagers committing suicide after being bullied has many people paying closer attention to these situations. Lori Anspach is with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, a nonprofit mental health watchdog group co-founded by the Church of Scientology.
There's almost a fear instilled in those empowered to enact the Baker Act, because if they don't enact it and that person does harm somebody, they can be held legally liable. And that is the crux of why it's important to clarify this rule, retrain those in authority to implement this law so that they clearly understand it and they can get out of the fear zone and act confidently.
As of April 3rd, the bill was released to the House and added to the second reading calendar. For Florida Public Radio, this is Chiel Roberts in Fort Pierce.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, after lawmakers announced they wouldn't be passing an anticipated gaming overhaul measure this legislative session, Regan McCarthy reports advocates are racing to get a Greyhound injury reporting measure passed before the session's end.
Run, babies! Run and play! See them going now? They'll come back this way. You might step back a little. They'll splash you. Come on! This way!
On a rainy Tuesday morning in Lamont, Florida, the Greyhound Johnny Depp, or Depp for short, is racing in a field of puddles with three other Greyhound friends and a Doberman Pinscher.
They just love to run. They don't all have to run, but some that do, like Depp and Willow, they will go like the wind.
That's Sue Henriksen. She adopted Depp when his name was the Flying Ichabod, after he retired as a racer at the Jefferson County Kennel Club.
And I thought he had nice, big, beautiful eyes, like our famous movie star, and I said, your name is Johnny Depp, so I call him Depp.
Henriksen says Greyhounds are known for their sweet and gentle personalities. But she says after she adopted Depp, it took a while for that to show up.
When I got Depp off the track, he was very, very aloof, you know. It took me like 6 months to get him to interact with me at all, because I don't ever think he had that type of oneness with an individual. And now, gosh, look at him now. He's my house hound, and is just very, very, I didn't think he had a personality. He was just flat. And now he's just the best boy. He really is.
And Maurice Mizrahi, who also adopted several retired racers, says that's one of the main reasons he opposes greyhound racing.
My problem with the greyhound racing isn't really the 30 seconds of racing they have. It's the fact that they spend the other 23 and a half hours a day in a cage being let out to pee.
Mizrahi says greyhounds are social, intelligent animals and need interaction. And he also says he's worried about what happens to the dogs when they stop racing. He says when he adopted one of his greyhounds, Hermes, he was 15 pounds underweight.
He stopped racing because he somehow decided to stop chasing the hare. I saw the last race on video, and he sort of came out and looked around, and he wasn't interested anymore, and then it's over. I won't say they stopped feeding him, but it became less and less and less until they were able to get him into rescue.
Both Mizrahi and Henriksen agree. Not every owner who races greyhounds is bad, and many dogs are well cared for. But they say that seems to be more of an exception than a rule, and they say a lot of that is because the dogs just aren't that important. Tracks hold races not because it's a moneymaker or a draw, but because they have to in order to offer poker games. And Hollywood Democratic Senator Eleanor Sobel says that's concerning. Sobel's filing a bill that would require officials to track injuries greyhounds sustain while racing. And Delray Beach Democratic Senator Maria Sachs is taking that a step farther by filing an amendment to that bill to decouple gaming and greyhound racing. In other words, changing a provision in state law that says only racing facilities can hold table games. Sachs says her amendment would still allow greyhound racing, but wouldn't require an event, she says a state report shows, ends up costing the state money.
For example, the cost to the state from mandated greyhound racing on page 421 of the Spectrum report is $4.1 million for the state of Florida to regulate this sport. On page 421, the total tax revenue collected from greyhound racing is $3.1 million. So this results in a deficit.
But after facing opposition from those with concerns the amendment would lead to an expansion in gambling, Sachs withdrew her proposal. Sobel's bill passed through the committee. Both Henriksen and Mizrahi say they're glad to see at least Sobel's injury reporting measure moving forward, saying it is a step in the right direction that might help protect some dogs and raise awareness about the dangers racing greyhounds can face. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Eben, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo, along with Ryan Bank. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. And join us again each weeknight during the 2014 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Tallahassee Regional Airport, offering service through U.S. Airways with direct flights from Tallahassee to Charlotte and Washington, D.C., and over 200 connections to destinations around the globe. Fares and information available online at usairways.com. Lisa Miller and Associates, offering strategies to solve legislative, regulatory, and business development challenges. Every challenge offers new opportunities for individually tailored client solutions. Online at lisamillerassociates.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 500,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace, online at flaflcio.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.